Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. This podcast is also sponsored by DocketWise, an all-in-one immigration forms and case management solution trusted by thousands of immigration lawyers across the U.S. I really like DocketWise. It makes immigration applications easy by allowing the clients to provide information through simple online questionnaires that are shareable by text or email and available in multiple languages. Not only that, DocketWise provides a comprehensive group of case management features, including invoicing and calendaring, secure messaging, task management, and a lot more. You can learn all about DocketWise and receive a 10% discount on your subscription by heading to docketwise.com/immigration-review, so they know we sent you. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. It's that time of year again. The time when Spotify tells you the 5 podcasts that you listen to the most. If you are part of the 13% of listeners who use Spotify to listen to the Immigration Review podcast, that's right, I got statistics. And if Immigration Review made your top 5, give us a share on social media and let us know. I promise to repost, even if we're not number 1 this year. As to this week, well, 6 decisions, and not a win in sight for non-citizens. Enjoy! Before getting to the cases, I wanted to talk a bit about Capital Good Fund. Millions of families seeking to improve their immigration status face financial barriers due to the high cost of legal services. Nonprofit Capital Good Fund is working to make these resources available to all, especially those who would not otherwise qualify for traditional loans. Certified CDFI Capital Good Fund is partnering with attorneys to provide the financial services that families need. They offer affordable financing with no closing fees or down payments for those working with attorneys to move their case forward and to get attorneys out of the accounts receivable business. To learn more about the program, email immigration@goodfund.us or call 866-584-3651 and tell them who sent you. First is Matter of K. Gupta, published by the BIA. This is the worst kind of podcast case, because this case is about the immigration attorney. Why not start off with it? With this decision, the BIA disbarred Mr. Gupta from appearing before the BIA, immigration courts, and the Department of Homeland Security. Kind of weird how the BIA, the neutral arbitrator, has authority to prevent attorneys from appearing before DHS, one of the litigants, before the BIA. But such is immigration. To begin the saga, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had suspended Mr. Gupta from appearing before that court for 6 months in October 2019. Shortly after that, and apparently connected to it, disciplinary counsel for both EOIR, the immigration courts, and DHS moved for Mr. Gupta's suspension from practice before EOIR and DHS. The BIA obliged in November 2019, suspending him for 6 months. After the 6 months expired, however, Mr. Gupta never moved to reinstate himself for practice. Apparently that means that under the regulations, he remains suspended, notwithstanding the fact that the 6-month suspension had expired. The regulation is pretty straightforward. Quote, "The regulations state that an attorney who has completed his or her period of suspension and who has filed a motion for reinstatement shall be reinstated once the period of suspension is expired if the attorney meets the definition of attorney set forth in the regulations, and the attorney has complied with the terms of his or her suspension," end quote. Looks like Mr. Gupta did comply, but he didn't file the necessary paperwork. Not only that, apparently, quote, despite being notified of his suspension, Mr. Gupta continued to practice before the BIA, the immigration courts, and DHS, end quote. That included, but was not limited to, not only appearing in immigration court and representing clients, but drafting briefs for clients, but then having them submit them before various courts and agencies, pro se. Not great, if true. So DHS and EOIR counsels moved for his disbarment. Mr. Gupta didn't timely respond. The BIA published its decision, disbarring Mr. Gupta from practice before the immigration courts and DHS. The BIA explained how it doesn't need to adopt proposed disciplinary requests from DHS and EOIR counsels, even if the targeted attorney fails to respond to the notice. However, quote, the allegations in this notice of intent to discipline establish that the respondent has represented at least 10 individuals before DHS or the BIA in spite of his suspension from practice before these bodies, end quote. It also appears that he may have misrepresented his suspension in his filings before the agencies. Relying on Section 8.1 of the American Bar Association's Standards for Imposing Lawyer Sanctions, the BIA relayed that disbarment, quote, is generally appropriate when a lawyer, intentionally or knowingly, violates the terms of a prior disciplinary order and such violation causes injury or potential injury to a client, the public, the legal system, or the profession, end quote. Yes, indeed, the ABA is trying to protect the legal profession. The BIA found these and other ABA standards for governing attorney practice persuasive and disbarred Mr. Gupta from immigration practice. Which really is a great segue into an issue I had already intended to discuss this week. As many of you may know, attorney Rekha Sharma Crawford, in addition to authoring a wonderful children's book on immigration, is leading a petition to have the BIA or Attorney General vacate matter of Lozada, published over 34 years ago and governing ineffective assistance of counsel claims before the immigration courts. Specifically, as Ms. Sharma Crawford argues persuasively, matter of Lozada's requirement that we attorneys file a bar complaint in conjunction with an ineffective assistance of counsel claim is damaging to the practice of removal defense and harmful to defense counsel. It is time for this requirement to be dissolved. Indeed, Ms. Sharma Crawford and I are unaware of any other area of law where clients or their attorneys must file a bar complaint against prior counsel to potentially obtain relief based on a meritorious, ineffective assistance of counsel claim. In this vein, the ABA Guides on Attorney Conduct, found persuasive and essentially adopted in this very decision by the BIA, have no such requirement. Nor has the BIA ever explained the circumstances, discussed as possible in matter of Lozada itself, whereby a bar complaint would be excused. This very case shows how the BIA is quite capable of governing the practice of attorneys before EOIR and DHS without need of attorneys filing bar complaints against each other. If you agree, sign Ms. Sharma Crawford's petition. I've included links to it in the show notes. And that is matter of K. Gupta. Sticking with the BIA, we have matter of Triana. A two-case week from the BIA. To what do we owe the pleasure? INA Section 245I, of course. That wonderful statute that technically hasn't existed in over 20 years, but which remains a way for non-citizens to adjust to lawful permanent resident status under very specific circumstances. INA Section 245I was the much more favorable adjustment of status statute before the 1996 change of law that I'm always lamenting. It has many non-citizen forgiving features, perhaps most favorably that it didn't require inspection and admission to adjust to LPR status, meaning that non-citizens could become LPRs based on their marriage to United States citizens, for example, no matter how they entered the United States. And so long as they weren't Communist Party members, of course. Steadfast feature of immigration law. Keep out the communists. The law was replaced with INA Section 245A with IRIRA, but had a grace period, and permitted non-citizens to benefit from the prior law so long as a visa petition, like a Form I-130 or an I-140, had been filed on the non-citizen's behalf on or before April 30th, 2001. Also applied to certain derivative family members. And I'm summarizing here. There are entire CLE panels on Section 245I, and even they only skim the surface. But even if that petition was timely filed, to benefit from the Section 245I grace period, the visa petition must have been approvable when filed, which is a legal term with a legal definition. It's what this case is about. And naturally, this issue implicates my favorite BIA decision of all time, the BIA's 2013 decision in matter of BUT. Enter Mr. Triana. He's from Mexico and married a woman in 1989. In 1997, his wife's LPR father filed an I-130 petition for the wife, incorrectly claiming that she was his unmarried daughter. Pretty important, because then, as today, there is no path for married adult children of lawful permanent residents to obtain a visa. Only unmarried adult children, of LPRs at least, are visa eligible. Former INS approved the petition anyway. After all, how could they know about Ms. Triana's legally unfortunate marriage? The wife never actually adjusted to LPR status based on that petition, although she did many years later through a petition filed by her adult U.S. citizen child. Confused yet? Fast forward many years. Mr. Triana somehow finds himself in removal proceedings and, as relevant to this case, applied to adjust LPR status under INA Section 245I. He must not have entered the U.S. lawfully, else I suspect that he himself would have just applied to adjust status under Section 245A through a petition filed by that same adult U.S. citizen child. So he needs Section 245I, and how might Mr. Triana be eligible? Well, as the spouse of Ms. Triana. Spouses of non-citizens who are themselves Section 245 eligible and who were spouses when the pre-April 30th, 2001 petition was filed can be grandfathered in and adjust to LPR status, even 20 years later, based on a new immigrant visa petition by using Section 245I. So here, for example, Mr. Triana could use his son's Form I-130 petition and adjust under Section 245I because his wife was the beneficiary of a different I-130 petition filed before April 30th, 2001. Confused yet? And honestly, all the ducks appear to be in a row. Unlike other complicated cases where the pre-April 30th, 2001 visa petition is never decided or is withdrawn or is denied by INS, Ms. Triana's petition was approved. Remember? Just one problem. She wasn't actually eligible for it. It was approved in error. Remember, she was not the unmarried daughter of an LPR at the time. In fact, Mr. Triana's eligibility depends on him being the husband of Ms. Triana, which, if that is true, would by definition not have made her eligible for the visa petition as the unmarried daughter way back when. The kind of catch-22 that the BIA just loves. The IJ therefore denied adjustment of status, and the BIA affirmed. The 11th Circuit sent it back to the BIA on Oyl's motion, and here we are, with quite the unique issue. As I mentioned, to benefit from Section 245I, a petition filed on or before April 30th, 2001, must not only have been timely filed, but must be, quote, approvable when filed, end quote. Seems intuitive that a petition actually approved would satisfy this phrase, but the BIA did not see it that way. That's because the relevant regulations define approvable when filed to mean, quote, properly filed, meritorious in fact, and non-frivolous, end quote. Here, the BIA deemed the petition not in fact meritorious in fact, because Ms. Triana was in fact married at the time. This, despite the fact that neither former INS, USCIS, or anyone else ever revoked the approved visa petition. And the reason the BIA said that that doesn't really matter is because, for example, in the podcast's favorite matter of but, the BIA defined meritorious in fact to mean that the petitioner, quote, merited a legal victory upon filing, end quote. Not so in the case of Ms. Triana's petition. On the flip side, it's important to remember that with cases like this, quote, the denial of a visa petition is not determinative of whether the visa petition was meritorious in fact. And denial or revocation does not automatically foreclose a determination that a visa petition was approvable when filed, end quote. You can still fight it out years later before USCIS or the IJ, everybody. But here, it also makes, quote, the inverse true, end quote. The approved I-130 petition all those years ago is not dispositive. Not gonna lie, while this seems to be a straightforward case for this proposition, it also potentially opens up the possibility of big fights requiring presentation of stale or destroyed evidence decades later on Section 245 eligibility, even where the I-130 or the I-140 was approved all those years ago. I do not love that possibility. The BIA analogized this issue to its 2021 decision in matter of Cagumbas, with approved I-130s and with an IJ's authority to relitigate that in adjustment of status cases. Episode 77. I don't believe I loved that either at the time. All of that means that Mr. Triano lost his case because neither he nor his wife were or are Section 245I eligible. But, as a matter of, while we're on the issue, as the BIA notes here, explaining what it noted in 2007, the lack of Section 245I places, quote, a significant administrative burden on the resources of the State Department and exposes the non-citizens themselves to considerable personal expense, end quote. Also an unmention is the fact that without Section 245I, thousands of non-citizens who are married to U.S. citizens and or who have other close U.S. citizen family members, or even those who are accomplished professionals and who are needed by U.S. companies, are nevertheless potentially subject to permanent exile from the United States and their family and livelihood based on their immigration history. Get involved with Immigrants List and bring back Section 245I. Indeed, in part due to Immigrants List's efforts, I believe that there's currently a bill languishing in the Senate introduced by Senator Duckworth that would do just that. And that is Matter of Triana. To the Circuits, with Song v. Garland, published by the Fourth Circuit on December 1st, 2022. This case is about K-1 fiancé visas of all things. Ms. Song is from Cambodia and entered the United States on a K-1 visitor visa as the fiancé of a United States citizen. Ms. Song and her fiancé complied with the law, she came to the United States, and they married within the time period required. Perhaps you've heard of the 90-day fiancé? An abomination to our profession! Ms. Song then applied to become a conditional lawful permanent resident, requiring that someone, usually the petitioning spouse, file a Form I-864 Affidavit of Support on her behalf. The Affidavit of Support is literally a contract between the signatory and the United States government, promising to make sure that the beneficiary, here, Ms. Song, doesn't become destitute, and that the sponsor, here, her U.S. citizen husband, will ensure that the U.S. government doesn't need to financially support the non-citizen in the future. These are signed almost every time a non-citizen becomes an LPR, and they remain in effect until a non-citizen naturalizes, abandons their residency, or works for 10 years. Thing is, by the time Ms. Song applied for conditional LPR status, her marriage wasn't going well, and her husband withdrew his Form I-864 petition. Now usually, an adjustment or immigrant visa applicant can obtain a different sponsor or a joint sponsor. It doesn't necessarily need to be the petitioning relative. But here, because Ms. Song entered as a K-1, USCIS held that it had to be her husband. USCIS therefore denied her application to adjust to conditional lawful permanent resident status and initiated removal proceedings. Ms. Song and her husband divorced. In removal proceedings, Ms. Song applied to adjust to CLPR status again, this time getting a U.S. citizen friend to sign the affidavit of support and contract with the U.S. government to make sure that Ms. Song did not become destitute. But the IJ and the BIA said that she couldn't do that. BIA said so by published decision, the 2018 decision, Matter of Song. When the BIA made its decision in this case, the BIA rejected Ms. Song's argument that the requirement that a petitioning spouse be the affidavit of support sponsor would completely shut the door on K-1 adjustment in the case of divorce. To the BIA, the only exceptions from having the petitioning spouse be the I-864 sponsor in the case of K-1 adjustment are, cryptically, quote, abuse and death, end quote. Was the BIA correct? The Fourth Circuit said, correct enough, that we'll defer to Matter of Song. To get there, under the Supreme Court's 1984 Chevron decision, the Fourth Circuit first said yes, the affidavit of support statutes are ambiguous. It doesn't appear that anyone really argued otherwise. Indeed, it appears that it wasn't even really the BIA filling in the statutory gap, but rather DHS by regulation. 8 CFR section 213A.2A1I, big I. Under that regulation, for K-1 beneficiaries like Ms. Song, quote, an intending immigrant is inadmissible as a non-citizen likely to become a public charge, unless the qualified sponsor specified in a different paragraph has executed on behalf of the intending immigrant an affidavit of support, end quote. That other referenced paragraph makes clear that for K-1s, the petitioning U.S. citizen must be the fiancé. A regulation pretty on point. Nor does the statute list what happens when the sponsor withdraws the affidavit of support, as occurred here. And again, there's a regulation to fill in the gap, at least somewhat. The BIA appears to have filled in the rest in Matter of Song itself. So having determined that the statute is ambiguous on the issue, the Fourth Circuit held that Matter of Song wasn't unreasonable. Quote, while Ms. Song contends it's unfair for the petitioning sponsor to have unilateral veto power over K-1 beneficiary's adjustment application, dependence on the K-1 petitioner permeates nearly every step of the K-1 process established by Congress, end quote. Then, citing to Patel, which really is just a dagger every time, quote, even if this apparent power imbalance might seem unfair to non-citizens in Ms. Song's position as a policy matter, were constrained by the statutes as Congress enacted them, end quote. All this, despite the BIA saying in its 2011 decision, Matter of Cisse, that, quote, divorce doesn't automatically foreclose a K-1 beneficiary's adjustment of status, end quote. But to the Fourth Circuit, the BIA has not now instituted a total ban on divorced K-1s from adjusting status, even if it looks like it'll be nearly impossible. And in any event, the Fourth Circuit deemed the BIA's reading of the statute reasonable. Ms. Song therefore lost her case. Here's Judge Quattlebaum in concurrence. For his part, Judge Quattlebaum concurred with the result, but believed that Kaiser Auer deference, rather than Chevron deference, should apply. Because what really was at issue to Judge Quattlebaum are the DHS regulations that I discussed a bit. And our deference is easier to challenge. Still not overcome here, but an important reminder about how important administrative law can be in immigration. Justice Gorsuch would certainly agree, and I'm sure will in some immigration decision in the next few years. Maybe to the non-citizen's benefit. And that is Song v. Garland. Next is Alexander Mendoza v. Attorney General of the United States, published by the Third Circuit on December 2, 2022. This decision is about waivers of appeal. And I cannot help but note that it says the phrase, the alien, 9 times in the opening paragraph. Mr. Mendoza grew up in El Progreso, Honduras, where 2 different gangs tried to recruit him. MS-13 in particular didn't like that he wouldn't join, and on a daily basis for about a year in 2000 and 2001, members would accost him and beat him with a machete handle. He came to the United States to escape it a year later at 18 years old. He entered without inspection and lived in New Jersey with his family. But he developed a criminal record, most if not all related to domestic issues with his then-girlfriend. Most were dismissed, but he was eventually placed in immigration and removal proceedings, where he accepted voluntary departure and returned to Honduras. 10-year bar for unlawful presence, by the way. Quote, his homecoming to El Progreso did not go well. The MS-13 gang robbed him, stabbed him, and broke his nose, end quote. Mr. Mendoza entered the U.S. without authorization again a few months later in October 2009, and he returned to the Dirty Jers, where he worked as an auto mechanic. He got into a domestic dispute again, though, in 2020, and DHS learned about him and detained him. He was placed in removal proceedings again, where he applied for asylum and related relief. All from detention during the pandemic, pre-widespread vaccine. He had an attorney for some of his proceedings, but after the attorney failed to get him a bond, possibly because Mr. Mendoza may not have told the attorney about his full criminal history, he apparently told the attorney that he wanted to represent himself, and the attorney was granted leave to withdraw. But the decision's also a bit unclear, and it gets challenged later. It's possible that Mr. Mendoza simply didn't have the money to continue having an attorney, a problem inherent in the immigration system, which does not provide public defender attorneys. Also, it's possible that counsel wasn't prepared. Either way, counsel left the case. And Mr. Mendoza represented himself 5 weeks later at his merits hearing. The immigration judge denied asylum as untimely and withholding of removal and cat protection on the merits. Mr. Mendoza, detained during the pandemic before the vaccine was widespread and without an attorney, told the immigration judge that he didn't want to appeal after the IJ said correctly that if he did appeal to the BIA, he'd likely remain detained for a longer period of time. To that, Mr. Mendoza said, in Spanish, quote, "I've decided to take the deportation, even though that I'm afraid to go there. But if I'm not going to be released on a bond to fight my case on the outside, I don't want to be incarcerated for any longer," end quote. When the IJ, knowing the finality of what was happening, asked again to really make sure, Mr. Mendoza said, quote, "No, I want to. I want to leave. I don't want to be locked up here any longer. I have not killed anyone. Those are the terrorists that attacked the Capitol," end quote. Which makes this the first immigration case that has managed to involve the January 6th insurrectionists, brought up by a detained Spanish-speaking non-citizen from Honduras to juxtapose his imprisonment to those many Americans who remained free, notwithstanding their complicity in an attempted overthrow of the U.S. government, the maiming of Capitol Police officers, and the resulting suicide of some of those officers. An interesting point, Mr. Mendoza. 11 days later, however, and perhaps because he was still detained, Mr. Mendoza changed his mind and filed a notice of appeal, pro se. The BIA dismissed the appeal for lack of jurisdiction because, said the BIA, Mr. Mendoza had waived appeal. Seemingly now, through pro bono counsel, he petitioned for review to the Third Circuit and also moved to reconsider with the BIA, which was also denied and made its way to the Third here. And the Third Circuit starts off with a bang, stating that, quote, "An alien's right to administratively appeal a removal order is not grounded in the Constitution," end quote. Rather, said the Third Circuit, it's a creature of regulation. And a non-citizen can waive that right, so long as the waiver is voluntary. The duress of remaining detained during a pandemic, it would seem, does not make a waiver involuntary. After going into detail about what the panel believes the substantial evidence standard means, the Third Circuit concluded that the BIA was correct to hold that Mr. Mendoza knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived appeal. And I mean, yes, the IJ did explain what it meant to waive appeal to Mr. Mendoza, and he seemed to understand based on the transcript relayed in this decision. And while the IJ, quote, "did not identify every downstream consequence of the waiver, such as the loss of a pathway to judicial review, complete knowledge of every potential consequence of a contemplated action is not required for a knowing waiver," end quote. The IJ even offered Mr. Mendoza an opportunity to think about it and to reserve appeal in the meantime while he thought, but Mr. Mendoza declined, seemingly so he could get out of immigration prison. Nor, to the Third Circuit, did the BIA err in denying a motion to reconsider on the issue. The court rejected the arguments that Mr. Mendoza made against his prior counsel because it believed a motion to reopen, rather than a motion to reconsider as filed, would have been the proper vehicle due to the fact that the motion sought to provide extra record evidence. Additionally, denying a due process challenge, the Third Circuit denied the petitions for review. I'm just going to move on. And that is Alexander Mendoza, the Attorney General of the U.S. To the Fifth Circuit we go, first with Hammerschmidt v. Garland, published on November 18, 2022. This case is about aggravated felonies and particularly serious crimes. Ms. Hammerschmidt is from Venezuela and was paroled into the United States in 2001 through deferred inspection. Unsure what happened there, but it seems interesting. Also unsure whether her parole was ever revoked, at least until 2009, when she pled guilty to making a false statement in an immigration petition in violation of 18 U.S.C. section 1546b. Then, in 2015, she and her husband were indicted for making false statements to the IRS in violation of 18 U.S.C. section 287. Although it appears that only $2,800 of tax refunds were at issue, there were 22 counts, and she and her husband were ordered to pay over $45,000 in restitution with 4 years imprisonment. That led to removal proceedings. An IJ sustained both immigration fraud and CIMT grounds of removability, and Ms. Hammerschmidt applied for withholding of removal, but an IJ deemed her tax crime an aggravated felony and a particularly serious crime for withholding of removal purposes, and then denied CAT deferral on the merits. On the CAT as one basis, the IJ deemed Ms. Hammerschmidt not credible. Tough case teed up here. The BIA affirmed, as did the Fifth Circuit. For what it's worth to the Fifth Circuit, no jurisdictional bar prevented it from reviewing the issues because of the relief and the protection challenged in this case. The Fifth Circuit just agreed with the IJ. First, on particularly serious crime. Not true. Ms. Hammerschmidt doesn't have a per se particularly serious crime for withholding of removal purposes. To be one, the crime must be an aggravated felony or aggravated felonies and have resulted in at least 5 years imprisonment. Ms. Hammerschmidt only got 4. That just means that an IJ then conducts a case-by-case analysis by applying the matter of NAM framework to determine whether the crime is nonetheless particularly serious. With all of that in mind, I'm a bit unclear why the Fifth Circuit engaged at all in a detailed aggravated felony analysis, because a crime does not need to be an aggravated felony to be a particularly serious crime. But it did. And it agreed that the 18 U.S.C. Section 287 conviction here was indeed an INA Section 101A43MI aggravated felony, a fraud or deceit conviction involving at least $10,000 in loss to the victim or victims. Now, Ms. Hammerschmidt appears not to have challenged the fact that the statute always requires fraud, and she did not challenge that restitution orders can be considered when determining the $10,000 amount of loss. Not necessarily settled law, that latter part at least, by the way. Seems to be in the Fifth Circuit, though. Quote, instead, Ms. Hammerschmidt posits that $45,000 cannot establish the loss to the victim because she pled guilty to just one count involving a loss less than $3,000, end quote. The Fifth Circuit wasn't convinced, because Ms. Hammerschmidt was held jointly and severably liable with her husband, meaning that she was liable for the whole thing. To the court, notwithstanding her actual conviction, the restitution order, quote, indicates that her conduct contributed to a total loss of more than $45,000, end quote. So the conviction's an aggravated felony. Is it nevertheless a particularly serious crime for withholding of removal purposes? Again, under matter of NAM, to determine, IJs must consider, quote, the nature of the conviction, the type of sentence imposed, and the circumstances and underlying facts of the conviction, end quote. As I mentioned, the Fifth Circuit affirmed the IJ, although it did not explain why Ms. Hammerschmidt's financial crime is of the nature that makes it particularly serious. BIA precedent often applies that label to violent crimes. Having so found, however, the Fifth Circuit went to the facts, explaining how, for example, Ms. Hammerschmidt's, quote, conduct in holding herself out as an attorney and preying on vulnerable persons, such as those who did not speak English, to develop tax returns and defraud the government, end quote, was particularly serious. Concluding with CAT deferral, the Fifth Circuit did not have cause to overturn the adverse credibility finding, even with evidence that Ms. Hammerschmidt suffers from PTSD, which may have affected her ability to testify. Nor did the evidence otherwise establish her CAT eligibility. The Fifth Circuit denied some other challenges, and therefore ruled against Ms. Hammerschmidt. And that is Hammerschmidt v. Garland. We therefore conclude with Enigwu v. Garland, published by the Fifth Circuit on December 1st, 2022. This case is about ineffective assistance of counsel motions to reopen. Bit of a theme this week. This case regards two brothers from Nigeria, the Enugu brothers. They overstayed tourist visas in the late 1990s and were placed in removal proceedings 10 years later. They failed to appear for their hearing and they were ordered removed in absentia. 3 years after that, in 2012, an attorney entered an appearance on their behalf and admitted the factual allegations and the charge of removability. Completely unsure how or why that happened with in absentia removal orders, but in any event, the attorney moved to withdraw almost immediately, a motion which was not granted for 3 years, 2015. So I guess an immigration court reopened the in absentia orders of removal? Unstated. But at an eventual hearing in 2018, the Enugu brothers, pro se, filed applications for asylum and related relief. By the time of their merits hearing a year later, they had a new attorney. But see, the Enugu brothers had not had their biometrics taken, which would have required that they submit certain asylum materials to USCIS and that USCIS schedule them for a fingerprint appointment. Admittingly, a bit of a complicated and unnecessarily multi-step process, if you ask me. The Enugu brothers blamed their current attorney. Quote, "The IJ then played the recording of the March 2018 hearing, where the IJ had stated the importance of, and the process for, fingerprinting," end quote, when the Enugu brothers had appeared before the IJ, pro se. After playing the recording, the IJ deemed the asylum applications abandoned and ordered the Enugu brothers removed to Nigeria. New counsel then came on about 5 months later, the third attorney for those keeping track, and filed a motion to reopen, claiming that the second attorney committed ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to remind the Enugu brothers about the biometrics requirement. The IJ denied the motion. See, the ineffective assistance motion to reopen itself was filed beyond the 90 days permitted for most motions to reopen, and the IJ didn't believe equitable tolling, even by 2 months, warranted. Plus, said the IJ, the Enugu brothers were made aware of the biometrics requirement. The BIA affirmed the denial of the motion, albeit in a split decision. The Fifth Circuit here agreed with the BIA majority. True, equitable tolling is available for motions to reopen. And true, ineffective assistance of counsel may be a ground for equitable tolling and reopening. But, quote, "it is not invoked by a garden variety claim of excusable neglect," end quote. Quite the phrase. And here, the Fifth Circuit didn't even really reach the issue because, and I must say, intelligently, quote, "there has been no argument that the untimeliness of the motion to reopen was the result of ineffective assistance of counsel," end quote. That is, even if the biometric stuff was ineffective assistance, and no one is saying that it necessarily was, the Enugu brothers and their third attorney, who is bringing an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, did not themselves explain a key requirement to win their motion, why they should be able to file past the 90-day filing requirement. The Fifth Circuit concluded by stating that recent Supreme Court precedent did not overturn Fifth Circuit prior precedent, holding that the Fifth Circuit lacks jurisdiction to review IJ and BIA denials of sua sponte reopening, and denied the petition for review. Really? No one comes out looking great in this one. Personally, I think a better procedure that would avoid all the issues in this case would be a procedure that automatically sets biometrics appointments when asylum applications are filed in immigration court. That's what happens when asylum applications are filed with USCIS, for example. Doesn't seem crazy to me. But then again, I've been called crazy. Some final odds and ends. Before we leave the Fifth Circuit, the court had a bit of an active immigration week and decided not to go en banc in the decision Confal Chavez v. Garland, episode 119, meaning that deficient notice to appear in absentia removal order reopening remains very confusing in the Fifth Circuit. Say that 5 times fast. And give the case a re-listen. And on that track, the Ninth Circuit decided to amend two of its prior decisions this week, Perez Camacho v. Garland, episode 119, and Bravo Bravo v. Garland, episode 117. But not so substantively. Don't worry about it. Take my word for it. Trust me. And of course, give the cases a listen again. And that is Enugu v. Garland. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases.
I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate for 5 credit hours, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all. And follow the show on Instagram and Facebook, at Immigration Review, and send us a tweet, at ImReview, that's I-M-M Review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.